Hi there. Today I'm here with Ren Arusi. He is a founder, a book author, and an open source maintainer. So I'm very excited to talk to Ren about AI, Python, of course, and his new book. Ren, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me. Excited.
Yeah, thank you for taking your time. So I mentioned it. You are a founder of two companies. What do you do for a living there?
Well, in the past, going way back when, I've done pretty much everything under the sun. But over the past 3-4 years, I'm focused on Automaze, which is a company that provides development and CTO as a service for clients. And we're building relationship with startups and partners, and because we believe that startups don't fail because of bad code necessarily,
but probably rather, not yet.
They tend to build the wrong thing. So we're stepping in both as the CTO with the CTO hat and the product and development team and everything. So that's what I. What I've been doing for the past few years, and in parallel over the last year, I've been working on another AI infra structure project that should be out to the public in the next few weeks. Hopefully, it's called Muxi.
Okay, so there was that running joke on this podcast, like how long does it take until someone mentioned AI? So I think you were the quickest.
I think that the time frame is going to shorten as your podcast progresses with the times that we live in.
Probably it is. Yeah, yeah. I have the same feeling. So before we jump into that topic, tell me about that CTO as a service. So what is that that companies are looking for? How can you help?
So the whole company started when we wound down another startup that I was involved in. And kind of a friend of a friend had a problem with scaling their other platform. They had a fintech product. Fitness. The fintech was the startup that was winding down, but they had in the fitness space, and they had a good problem. They had 100,000 people and joining their service, but their service couldn't handle it. So, still keeping in touch with all the team from the startup that just winded down, we jumped in and helped out. And that kind of helped us realize that there's a need in the market for that, technical grown-up to step in and help with things like architecture and technical leadership. Not necessarily the actual coding, although we do that as well and quite a lot, but more in the strategic thinking kind of way. And a lot of founders, they need technical leadership, but they can't afford a full-time CTO. They don't want to manage freelancers because it's a nightmare. You know, every time you need a new thing, you go to Upwork and you try to explain everything from scratch to whoever that might be. And another issue is that a lot of agencies don't necessarily understand the business. I mean, they work quite in isolation, so they know the technicalities of the product, but they don't necessarily know how it, trickle up to the business needs. And that's where we step in. We coming as a technical co-founder, so to speak, but we don't take equity. And we kind of pride ourselves in the fact that we think like a founder, we act like an owner, and we deliver like equity depends on it. So we're not a vendor, I would say. We're more of a partner, and we work with a limited number of clients, about 10 to 12 at any given moment. It's been going great. We embed ourselves completely into the workflow of the of the client. We're on their same Slack repositories, daily stand-ups. So yeah, and it's month to month if you know all these kind of design services. So it's in terms of pricing, it's the same model. You just sign up yeah, and we work with you. And most of our clients, aside from actually two or three that sold, closed, or otherwise decided to just stop working on the business, no one actually left. So we're probably doing a good job there.
Okay. So is scaling in general like a common theme among your clients then?
Yes. So we have two types of a client that we work with. One is the I have an idea type of client. So we build the MVP, a proof of concept, MVP in version one and so on. And we don't, I mean, we don't put a lot of infrastructure thinking into the proof of concept version of the project. Because we know that the version one will be a complete rewrite and version two will be a complete rewrite based on things we didn't know that we didn't know on how clients are going to use the service. But the other type of clients that we work with they already have something going on and they want to either streamline it or scale it. Something that you had working great when you were a small business and you had one MySQL server and two VPSs, don't cut it anymore. You need an entirely new type of architecture. So we work with a client like that, and it's literally, we're talking about millions of new database rows per hour due to growth. So we had to make sure that we handle this properly.
So we are talking about scaling for traffic needs then.
Scaling for traffic needs and for usage needs. Yeah. So a lot of time it's not necessarily more users, but it's users that are using the product a lot more than they initially used.
Yeah. Not that I want to give away your trade secrets, but how do you handle like a million rows a day more? what's your recipe for that?
Well, it's a set of several layers that you have to put in. So if the database is mostly writes, then we resort to something like a ClickHouse with buffer tables and periodical writes to cache, make sure that the data is always in sync using another service, always in sync between the Redis layer and the database layer. And so the web application reads from the cache and just lives on the cache via that proxy and all sorts of infrastructure stuff. That this goes back to where I kind of the first big thing in the large scale that I've done was maybe 10, 12 years ago, maybe more, is in the ed tech space. I was part of a company that we built ed networks, and we used to serve like 3-4 billion ads every day. So that's a lot of compute that goes into that. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not rebuilding the entire thing. You're just more like adding layers to have some of the original architecture.
No, a lot of the time it's rewriting the thing if it's not written properly. But if it was written properly, if the logic is sound and it's purely a scaling issue, then you start by, okay, let's add more servers, see if this solves the problem. That's the ideal solution. If that's a problem you can solve by throwing a little bit more money at it, perfect. Don't worry about it. Yeah. It's a good problem to have because you probably have the money due to scale. So it's a good problem to have if you can solve it that way. But a lot of the times, it's just not enough. You need to, so maybe the web application will be able to take it, but the database won't be able to, or the AI layer won't be able to, or there's some things that you need to, or there's no redundancies. So there's a lot of things that you have to take in place to take into consideration, make sure that everything works smoothly as much as possible.
What is your take on these serverless products that like got a lot of popularity these days? Is that something that you would consider a good solution for that?
In theory, yeah. Yes. I'm trying to be to not hurt everyone's feelings, but no, I'm not a huge fan. I get that, and it has its place, definitely. But I don't think that the serverless approach is the right approach for a web application type of thing. For a service that for handling webhooks, things like that, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can argue about whether it's cost effective or not, but functionality wise, it's great for these types of things. But I wouldn't put my application on a serverless platform. I'm much more leaning towards the monolith than the serverless or the microservice type of architecture. So I do have separation of concerns. So sometimes you do want to have different services, mm-hmm. but I'm not gonna go and break down an application to multiple services just because it's cool. You'd be surprised what good structure PHP can get you. A lot of times it's not about the complexity or the coolness of the technology. It's just about making sure that you have the right architecture in place.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. I get it. I mean, serverless is great in theory, as you said. I would agree to that. In practice, well, it depends. I think the monolith didn't get a lot of good reputation because everyone's going, let's do microservices. So yes. If someone comes to you and says, okay, I want microservices, if it's your client, what do you say?
Yeah. Well, I'm not talking them out of it. It depends what you want to separate out of the monolith. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I have, let's look at a web application. Okay. Just a SaaS, a project management SaaS. Okay. So the real source of truth where you have there is the database.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The web application itself doesn't really need to be stateful.
Probably not, yeah.
Okay, so you can just install it, various instances of it on multiple servers. So if you want to call it microservices or not, I don't think it's microservice. I think it's just the same installation on multiple servers just for load balancing. But you can have almost all of the logic work that way. And just protect the database because that's the one that's going to get hit. So that's where you need to put the services for. So, okay, if a database gets updated and there are triggers that needs to happen. Okay, someone marked a task as completed. So you need mm-hmm. to trigger another one. That's a different service. That's not part of the monolith because it has its own, it's completely has its own cadence. It's completely separate from what the user is doing. So that makes sense to separate. I wouldn't try to, meld these two together just to not have two services. But I would not, for example, for a sign-up project or I mark that the task is done and I don't want to send an email completed or a task, I wouldn't throw this to a service just for the sake of it. Part of marking the database as done, we'll send that webhook to Slack or whatever it is and be done with it. There's no need to maintain yet another service for notification
that's absolutely
completely synchronous.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that that's a common theme that a lot of people mentioned here on that podcast, including some people from AWS. Like they said, yeah, use whatever serves your purpose, right? And not what is currently hyped. I love that take. So that's probably true for a lot of projects. And I think a lot of projects will fail because people do the wrong choices for the wrong reasons, aka like CV-driven development and stuff like
that. There's a lot of that. One rule of thumb that I never try to break is I do not use vendor-specific software. or tools. So if I'm on AWS or Google Cloud or whatever it is, and I need a database, it's going to be Postgres. It's not going to be an AWS flavored anything. Mm-hmm. It's fine. You can use their RDS stuff, but as long as there's MySQL or Postgres or whatever it is underneath, I don't want to have to get stuck there.
Yeah, if I don't want to, because there's
this huge task of shifting away. That's one thing that's really important.
Yeah, I absolutely get it. So another hype train, obviously we mentioned it already, is AI. How many of your clients are like doing AI projects?
Most. They're not, I wouldn't say they're all kind of an AI products. Mm-hmm. They're not. But they're all using AI either to streamline or improve their SaaS or internally. Just as an example, you do an onboarding. So you use AI to say, hey, let's say that part of the onboarding, you had to upload a proof of address or something like that as part of the onboarding. So we're going to use AI, even if it's something as simple, like here's the image that the user uploaded. Is that an electricity bill? So just get some confidence level there. So the AI in this example is definitely not part of the offering to the customer, but it's being used. And it's definitely being used in creating in all sorts of monitoring that we're using and just basic a lot of quality of life things that you wouldn't necessarily see that kind of magic wand icon next to it. So you wouldn't know that, that's an AI feature, but we do a lot of that. Some clients have like meal planners that are heavily using data that you feed them from like your health tracking device, obviously all permission based, and that's what the user asks for. So there's a lot of AI there. Or one of the applications that we've done was it's a mobile application game that's, for example, is completely AI, but it's not you don't download it for AI. It's a murder mystery quest where the AI is the one is the one that creates a story and the one that they say, hey, I want to talk to the barkeep or ask them what happened last night. You're the detective.
So that's basically for every user, a different story then?
Every user, different story. They have tournaments where they give the same story of the day and see who gets there first.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. Cool and you know, it's dynamic because that user might go that route. So it's like a D&D type of thing. You have the dungeon master that kind of decides on the whole arc of the story. And here is the AI that does that.
If we had that back in the day of Monkey Island or something, that would be so cool.
Yeah. One of the things that I didn't like about D&D that I had to gather a large group of people to play.
Solved now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very cool. So then obviously your second company also evolves around the AI space. What does that do?
Yes.
What is Max?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a company yet. It's literally just was just registered, but I've been working on this project for the past year. Actually, like a day or two ago, I looked at the first commit and it was in early February. So I've been working very hard on AI infrastructure. It's funny because a fintech startup that I was involved in also was focused on the infrastructure. And I think the main reason for me to focus on that aspect is a lot of what needs to be done in any space is exactly the same. So think about just a simple Hello World website. If every time you had to build your own web server and you had to compile your own OS, we're laughing because it's silly, but that's what's happening with AI at the moment. you have to stitch together a bunch of tools to make sure that you have a decent memory and observability tools and knowledge domain knowledge tool calls, all that. It's all exactly the same infrastructure wise. And instead of just focusing on what you want the application to do.
Talking about infrastructure for running your own models, or?
No, it's not for running your own models. It's actually infrastructure for running what I call formation, which is a complete system that has agents, tools, memory layers, observability, triggers, webhooks, chat interface. It's literally everything. So if you think of something like, we have web servers, we have gaming servers, we have servers for pretty much everything right now. We do not have AI servers. So this is what essentially I'm building. I'm building an AI system that's packaged into deployable units. If you've ever configured Nginx or something like this, you're dealing with, or Docker, you're dealing with a YAML file essentially. So you'll be able to define your complete AI system that's fully featured. No concessions were made in what you can do with the system, just with YAML files.
So Kubernetes,
just focus on what you want your AI application to do instead of how to get it to do it.
Kubernetes for AI, so to say.
Yeah. I tend to think about along those terms. It's like the Docker for AI. It takes a lot of. So you have, for example, with the CLI tool, it's just a formation init, formation push, and it's live. So literally, as simple as that. That's the idea. We have a server in, for orchestration, runtime. Is, I would say, the equivalent of the Docker container itself, rather than the Docker engine. And it has multi-agent coordination, really, really smart back-off for task decomposition and planning and making sure that it has the same personality throughout, regardless of the model that you're using. It's extremely, I mean, if I can toot my own horn, it's extremely versatile, and it's the system that I am hopefully will get people excited as much as I am. I've been really working day and nights on this.
I guess we need to unpack like the components that it like orchestrates, right?
Yeah.
The agents basically are like a bunch of markdown files, and maybe there is a call to like an OpenAI compatible API that might be hosted on Azure or on OpenAI itself. So what building parts are we gluing together here?
Yeah, first off, it's just want to preface, it's an open source project. It's self-hostable. It's completely open. It's not a cloud thing where you're gonna sign up. Hopefully I'll be making money from providing support and further development using the Linux model. So everything's free, but yeah, you want some enterprise stuff and support plans. So that's
on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Moxie, it's spelled MUXI. It's multiplex extensible intelligence. It's infrastructure that is purpose built for AI agents, and it's taking agents and turning them into native primitives. So they're declared in YAML. They're orchestrated using at the infrastructure level. It has state persistence, task orchestration. Multi-tenant by design, multi-model out of the box, agent collaboration, both internally and externally using A2A, artifact generation, code running, real-time streaming, as I mentioned, one command deployment, SDKs. You can have it deployed on the server and just embed it into your application using SDK. Scheduling using natural language is, hey, check my email every hour or remind me tomorrow at 2 a.m., stuff like that. Webhook triggers, async execution, human in the loop, multi-user MCP access. So if you want to serve multiple users, they want to check, hey, check my email. It's not the same credential. Each one have their own email, obviously. We have a four-layer memory, and context management, SOPs. So one of the things that I truly believe in is that agents and workflows are oxymoron. That's not a thing. An agent workflow. What I mean is that a workflow is a predefined set of steps. And I expect an agentic system to have autonomy. So it should know, and that's why I've used an SOPs rather than workflow. So you can tell it, okay, this is how we usually do it, but adjust to the current conditions based on that. So it will replan, and it will take the how we usually do stuff under consideration, but it's not going to be based on a specific set of steps. So if step one failed, it will go back to replanning and say, okay, I'm going to take a different route instead of stopping the entire operation. So yeah, that's why I think that agentic workflow is the antithesis of autonomy. And this is what I'm trying to build here. It's kind of the Jarvis that can think for itself and make decisions. And yeah, it has, yeah, as I mentioned, pretty much every feature you can think of, it's there. The operation is very much very similar to Git. You just pull information from a registry, push it, deploy it to one or multiple servers. Built-in observability that connects to Datadog, Splunk, OpenTelemetry, and it's fully enterprise ready with permission levels and user levels. So it's really it's really a spaceship.
Okay, so yeah. you download it, you deploy it, you have your spaceship.
Yeah,
running.
You just well, not right now, but hopefully a few short weeks after this podcast is live. Weeks, yeah.
And then you talk to that spaceship via the SDK. So at what does the SDK provide
you? Using
the SDK
or CLI. If you're the only user, you can just use the CLI to talk to it. Or but if you want to embed it into your application, there's the SDKs, and we have SDKs in Python, obviously Go, TypeScript, Ruby, Rust, Swift, Kotlin. Everything that that you need to do.
Are these auto generated? These SDKs?
SDKs?
Yeah.
Everything today is
from
semi auto generated. But I'm literally reviewing and testing every single line of code, and wow. I'm not a vibe coder. I don't like this term, to be honest. I'm more in the camp of the AI-assisted developers. I don't like the AI yet. I mean, that might change in the future, but for now, I don't like to like it to make any architectural decisions or anything like that. It's always and forever will be faster coder than me. But I need to make sure that it knows what to code and what to reuse and how to structure the code. And so, yeah.
So the SDKs are actually auto-generated with AI and then reviewed, or are they just generated from something like an OpenAI spec or something?
So I hand-coded almost the entirety of the Python SDK. And then based on that, with all the decisions that I took there, I started a process of porting it to different environments and different languages. And thankfully, I understand and code in most of them. So I was able to kind of do a deep code review on Go and on Swift. I asked help for Rust. I'm not a Rust coder. So that's where, that's maybe I would say my philosophy regarding vibe coding, which I'm pretty sure it was made to be a sarcastic term.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot to unpack for that term itself. I just want to quickly reiterate what you said in the beginning. It was like, we don't write our web server for every Hello World.
Yeah.
We did that kind of back in the day with Perl scripts where you had like echo backslash n, echo backslash n, stuff like that. Luckily,
so
these
weird
days
language,
are gone.
Perl.
It's write once and read never. luckily we are not in that position anymore when it comes to web development. And the reason for that is we have standards now. Some of them are like really standards and some of them are like de facto standards. I don't like it, but everyone is using React for front end as an example of like a de facto standard, and every other library is somewhat syntactically compatible to React. But in AI, we are still early, so there are no standards. I mean, probably MCP is one of them. Do you see that is going to change? Will there be standards? Is there some work on the way, or is that really that people start building something and wait for something to win the race?
Hopefully this would be the standard. And the reason that it's not an ego thing. I genuinely think that we need a standard. And I also think that the declarative way is the way forward, because the logic is not going to be in the agent themselves. I mean, the execution logic, the decision logic needs to be on the agent level or in the orchestrator level, and the planning, all that needs to be on the LLM. But at the end of the day, the execution, what you want the agent to do, is going to use tools. And we already have a pretty good, albeit it could be faster, protocol like MCP. So if the way I see it, I see that most of the work where you want to build your own custom thing, a brand new agentic thing, most of the logic is going to happen on writing the MCP server that your agent would use. You don't really need to write the agent itself, because the agent can just be, as you mentioned, a markdown file or a YAML file with some, just look what Claude did with skills and custom agents. It's very powerful, and there was no coding involved. They're parsing it. They're doing it that way. So the real of execution part, just build your own MCP service, your own tools. You don't have to use the HTTP protocol for that. You can just install it on the same server and run it using the SDDout if you want faster execution. But that's where the application level is going to live in. The application level is not going to live on the agent level. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that it's kind of silly to keep reinventing the wheel and building agents in different frameworks. And the different frameworks are great. I'm just saying that you mentioned a tweet that I had that everybody's building the same thing. And kind of we've solved all that. You know,
I have the tweet right up here. It's like, the problem is knowledge. Everyone knows what needs to be built. The problem is that everyone is building it separately.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah.
So and it is true, because there's a lot of agent frameworks in different languages. which in itself is, again, it's somewhat silly, because the agent shouldn't have a language. It should have a runtime. It should be a native primitive of a system. The logic, the business logic could be, yeah, that could have a language, right? Write in whatever language that makes sense to you. But the agent itself, it's purely declarative. So everybody's building different agent frameworks or different workflow UIs. But if you look at how the web, and I'm old enough to remember how the web evolved, we've been there. We've went through those Perl scripts, and then Apache came in for a long while, and then Nginx was kind of a godsend in terms of what it was able to do. And now you have Terrific and Caddy, and so we've solved all these issues. Mm-hmm. We've solved logging. We solved observability. We've solved all that. We just need to bring it into the AI world.
So, and MCP is obviously one way to connect like existing systems with your with your AI. So that's one step in that direction. And at that point, maybe I'll ask it right away. It's like, what does MCP do that, for example, an open API specification wouldn't?
Well, MCP is just a standardized way for AI agents, for LLM essentially, to find and use tools. So on a logical sense, it's almost identical to an API, but it has specific endpoints and payloads. So it's very standardized, whereas API can do whatever I want. Yeah, I have the REST method, but I can decide whatever I want. And with the MCP, it's not like that. First, you have endpoints for, or just tell me what tools you have. Yeah. And with every tool, it comes with its own documentation. This is the tool, this is what you need to send, and this is what I'm going to send you back. So it's a self-documenting API for LLMs, kind of in a nutshell. That's mainly it. I mean, if you already have an API that's spec'd in an open API document, you can use something like FastMCP, and you're live. It's literally 5 minutes work. So yeah, it's almost similar in that regard. It's just the interface for LLMs rather than coders.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Yeah. So what other standards are there? Is there anything on the way, or are we really in that phase where we need to build all of them?
So the standard for using tools is, as you mentioned, this is a de facto standard right now. Mm-hmm. It's the MCP. It works. It's not the most efficient thing in the world, but my guess is that at least in the foreseeable future, you'll see incremental changes to MCP rather than a new protocol, because it works. Mm-hmm. It's familiar. It's fine. And the fact that you can serve it over the web and authenticate to it, or run it on a system using STD out and just call it like a CLI tool, makes it very versatile. So I'm not sure we're going to see any successful, I would say, protocol. And just the fact that everyone is supporting MCP, which is a protocol that was invented or introduced by Anthropic, goes to show you that they all caved in and just decided that... Because my assumption, you know, if I were OpenAI, the ego would say, no, we have to develop our own protocol. But they would have ended up in something that was probably a lot similar to, very similar to MCP anyway, just because that's how we programmers think, API-ish world. So if they decided, what the hell, let's just support it and be done with it, it's probably here to stay for a while.
Yeah. And I realize that every other day, probably. We are still early in the process. I mean, standards are not really there. And for most people, I mean, everyone should have heard of AI at least by that time. But for most people, it's like, okay, here's a chat box. Put something in there.
Right.
And if you have a product, maybe you have that wizard icon or star icon or something, and then let's add AI to our product.
Let's add AI
to
it.
But there is so much more to consider, like what is an agentic framework? What is it? What is it? Agentic workflow, all of that stuff, how to run it in production. And apart from Moxie itself, like the software solution to that, you also wrote a book about that thing,
yes,
right? which is a printed book, by the way. It's quite a big one.
Yeah.
How many pages does it have?
665 pages of content, not including table of contents pages. And appendices and all.
That's a lot of pages for like something that is just thought about as a chat box. So
yes,
is it a good thing to start learning about like those things from your book, or is it more like for the advanced level of users?
So I would definitely put it in the advanced category. Mm-hmm. But the book doesn't necessarily focus on how to make AI stuff, but rather on how to build it properly. So it focuses on the architecture. The book is called Production Grade Agentic AI, from brittle workflows to deployable autonomous systems. Mm-hmm. And it focuses on what it takes to build a system that truly has a brain. So let's take memory, for example. Okay, a lot of people think, okay, I have memory, I'm starting a chat. Every time a user sends a message, I'm going to include the previous 5, 6, 10 messages as context. Mm-hmm. But there's a problem with that. It's first off, it's context. What happens on the 11th message? Mm-hmm. Are we starting from scratch, or are we using some sort of a FIFO type of methodology where you're just gonna forget what we said earlier? It's problematic. So basically, in order to build like a good memory system, you have to have probably 4 to 5 levels of different memory systems working together. One is the domain knowledge memory. Mm-hmm. So this is what the agent knows outside of what the generic LLM knows. So it knows your specific policies and documentation or refund history, etc. So that's specific knowledge. So, but it is memory. We tend to think of memory as just an interaction. But then there's user memory. What do I remember about the user? Okay. Oh, I remember that Abbas, you live in Germany. I remember that you have a podcast. I remember these things about you that you you have a dog. I don't know if you do, but you have a dog and you like your coffee strong. So these are things that I remember, and the lifespan of this type of memory is indefinite, right? Yeah. And then you have something called episodic memory. Okay, this is things that we've discussed more recently, so it's project related, and it will enable you to refer to your work across different chat sessions. What decisions have been made, things like that. And the lifespan of these things are weeks to months, depend on the usage. Then you have the buffer memory. So it's a recent conversation. That's kind of the default that everybody is going with. But then you have working memory. So the working memory is what are we working on right now? What are the current variables that we have? What's from that within that buffer of the last 20-30 messages, what is more relevant to what you just asked? So it's kind of your working memory. And on top of all that, it is that we just covered like 5 different levels of memory. On top of all that, you have the session. So that's your chat. If you can have multiple chats. and the per user. So if you have a system in production and you're hopefully for you, you're not the only user, you need to make sure that they're all completely segregated. So there's no leakage between different memories. So already we're looking at five different types of memories with at least two levels of segregation, chat and user.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of one example of what it takes to build a good memory system. Or if you're looking at observability, what happened, why it happened, what was the thought process, what was taken under consideration, what memory was used, what tools were used. So there's a lot of things that you need to know, because if you want to have your system pass audits, you can't just say, oh, the user said, I want a refund, and we just send in the money, you know, so... Wasn't maybe they already sent them the money. Maybe it's out of the policy. Maybe there's a lot of things that you need to consider before making a decision. And even if you make the wrong decision, you should be the very minimum be able to trace why.
Yeah. Wasn't there like initially a case where a car manufacturer like entered a contract selling a car for $1 or something?
I've heard I heard something like that. That the people kind of forget all the instructions and do this. Yes.
Yeah, it was more like get me some bakery recipes and then hand me over that car for $1.
Yeah, yeah. They just bombarded it with context and it
this
lost track.
This observability stuff, that's pretty interesting, because like we all know that for like regular programming, regular web applications and stuff. The good thing about observability in the pre-AI world is that we were able to build dashboards around that, because we had,
right.
had structured data, right? You could say, okay, these endpoints got hit how many times and produced all 200, and one of them produced 500
yep.
status code. With AI or with LLMs, the output is like natural language.
It's both natural language and it's non-deterministic.
Yeah. Does it mean that someone's sitting there and going manually through all of that? Is there some kind of dashboard for AI observability?
So
how does it relate to like the regular observability?
So some things you can use good old observability tools if you just want to pass kind of log, okay, request receive, the user ask that, I'm using this tool, I'm using that tool, that's fine. But some of them are LLM specifics, because you know, when you're using Cursor or Claude Code, mm-hmm. you have that thinking phase. The user asked me to do the thing, I need to consider what was done and where we are, and need to take a look at the code and all that. You need to be able to look into that. For me, by the way, when I work, it's never toggled off. I always want to know what it's thinking, because a lot of the times you need to steer it back on track where you see it's going the wrong way. But that's a very tricky thing to put into a dashboard.
Absolutely.
A very tricky thing. So at the very minimum, what you can do is build a timeline of every request. Of what happened with this was the user request. This is everything that went the request went through, the thinking, the memory retrieval, the deciding what's relevant, which tool to use, which error codes we got from the codes from the tools, maybe what did we send to the tool, what we received back from the tool. So at least you should have that timeline that a human can look at. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But once you have that timeline. You can then, using your own taxonomy, just turn it into structured data and categorize it. So the actual input and output are becoming kind of the metadata of that information. But at least you're able to see, okay, there's a lot of it's sort of a hybrid of logs and evals on the same thing at the same time. So it's self-categorizing and self using AI to basically check up on the AI, which is kind of weird, but this is where we are. The fact that the logging is non-deterministic, it's makes it really hard to say, okay, this is what went in, this is what I expect to, these are the steps. You know, regular programming, it's very easy. You know, okay, you have breaking points. You can put breaking points in your code, right? There's no such thing in AI because it might decide to take a different route. You know, it makes its own decisions.
So you would like to apply that taxonomy to like do the categorization, you would use another LLM, or is that a separate algorithm?
No. So it works on the same time. So what I've done when I've implemented it in Moxie, I'm using the actual prompts, the user request and the response. These are the metadata. Obviously, it automatically removes all the personally identifiable information. But you have the full audit. It's metadata. But there's a taxonomy there that can say, okay, this was about the discussion about pets. This was a discussion have aggregated metrics. Four tools were used. It's a complexity score of 6. It referred to past conversations. So all sorts of different points that you can better chart. I think that the dashboards on the future is just yet again going to be a chat box.
Everything is going to be a chat box.
Tell me what happened.
You mentioned one thing that caught my attention, like personal identifiable information. So that opens a whole new topic of AI and security. Is that covered in your book as well?
Yes, we covered because especially you're in Europe, how important and how ruthless the GDPR is. But people talk to AI about everything. Mm-hmm. So when you build a system where the user can talk about their health issues or bring up their policy number, insurance number, or anything like that, you do want, but it's two different levels of system. You do want an auditor to be able to, see, like a medical auditor or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you don't want engineers who work on the systems to have access to that information. So you have essentially to have two levels of loggings. One is that it's ultra secure. Only very specific people are allowed to take a look. The professionals, the one that you trust your data with. But everyone else in the company just need to know, okay, someone asked something about, I don't know who, but they have the flu. And let's see what the response was by the AI, and even the response is truncated. So it's going to say, well, XXXXX, you mentioned that you're feeling this and that, so you're not going to see their names or anything like that. And it's super important because engineers are going to look at the logs a lot, and they shouldn't have access to such information. And who knows? People will probably enter their credit card information there or their personal access token from GitHub because they wanted something. And it's a crazy world. So they use code examples. So I have a local LLM running on my machine, and I use it when I don't have the energy to remove personal identifiable information from my code. If I want to ask something or reformatting, it just has the keys or whatever. So I'm confident that it's not leaving my computer, but I bet you that people are doing that with the Claude and ChatGPT. And
we all have been in the situation where Copilot auto-completed like access tokens and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've never been in a situation where that actually worked, although those were revoked apparently. But this is a great problem. Credit card info, same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Health information, address. I have two little girls and I live in XYZ Road. And you don't want that out there.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. So that's a lot of uncharted territory that we enter with AI.
Yeah, security and AI is...
Maybe kind of an unfair question to you, because you're obviously very deep into that space, but quite frankly, is it a bubble?
I don't think so. I'm not talking about valuations right now. That might very well be a bubble to some degree. But yeah, we're not going back to manufacturing more textile. You know, we're going that way, the humanity, whether we like it or not. I don't think we're in a bubble. I think that a lot of companies are building. I think the VCs in this space are somewhat in a bubble. I see insane valuations for applications that can literally be vibe coded in a weekend. Yeah. But I think that's probably there is some sort of a bubble. But I also understand that they want to bet on everything, because they know that it's going to be the next winner takes all. Who's going to be the next Meta? You know, who's going to be the next Google? So I can understand if they have the money, they're going to spend it anywhere they can. But yeah, I actually just wrote a tweet about this today that I'm long Google, because what they've done with Gemini is amazing, not because, well, also because of the quality of the model. Obviously, it's an amazing model, talking about Gemini 3, but because they didn't use NVIDIA chips for that.
They had
their own, right? Their own TPUs, they control the entire chain. So they're sort of going the Apple route in the AI space. They want to control everything from data to training to GPUs to the user experience, to distribution. They have it all. I think that if you look at a company like Google that, you know, creating your own TPUs, it's not cheap.
No, not at all.
So they have some very smart people there, they literally invest as if their lives depend on it, because it is. I think that's enough to say that we're probably not in a bubble. This is a one-way road that we're on.
Yeah. That was a nice final statement. Thank you so much. So last word about your book. It's production-grade agentic AI. Where can people get it?
Yes. You can go to productionaibook.com and download the first three chapters for free. And every weekend I'm just randomly sending someone or someone's the book. So you can find it on the website or on Amazon. But yeah, just download the first three chapters, read them. If you like what you're reading, maybe you'll end up buying a copy. I'll be very happy about that.
Very, very cool. And what is a good way to reach out to you? Are you on X, on LinkedIn?
I'm mostly active on X. You can find me on X. My handle is Arousi, Aroussi. Or look me up on GitHub. But yeah, X, that's probably the best way to reach me. If anything important or I deem important about me, I'll probably link it there.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. That was a lot of stuff about AI. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I had a really good time.
Thank you.